This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
They tried to make me go to rehab, but I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back,
good evening and welcome to Hooked, Joy 94.9's program about addiction. Research shows that the LGBTI community has addiction problems of at least twice that of the general population, and we want to explore why and how this has come about. There are many suffering an addiction, many more that are affected by those in active addiction, and people that are grateful in recovery. My name is David.
Hey, David. My name is Russ. What we're going to try to find out are some of the reasons behind this problem. Are there pathways towards recovery and change? How does addiction affect loved ones, family members, and partners of those in active addiction? I can tell you, are not experts in this field, but we're a couple of mates that both happen to be in recovery together. We believe there is a need for this conversation to be had in our community.
Definitely right there, Russ.
Right on.
You can also find us on Facebook, Hooked on Joy 94.9. And of course, if you're experiencing immediate problems or if content of this program raises issues that cause distress, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36.
Another year speeds by, or another week, I should say, speeds by.
Yes, it does.
We had a good show last week. We had a 12-step meeting in the studio, and I hope people had some help with the myths of what it's like going to a 12-step meeting being disqualified.
Yeah, look, I really enjoyed asking the questions because it was interesting to find out what actually happens and, you know, some of the rituals that are there in place and how it actually works. So,
but this week we move on to something very exciting. What is it, David Gale?
Well, tonight we have the pleasure and the honour to have Tori Orton, who is a psychotherapist, a practicing psychotherapist here in Melbourne. Welcome, Tori, to Hooked on Joy 94.9.
Thank you, and I'm looking forward to being directed about what I should be saying here, which is going to be helpful to me because I'm mostly sitting in a chair with people listening to them talk and helping them find what they're looking for. And so I'm guessing that part of what's going on here is we're looking for some things together, but I don't know exactly what they are, and so I need help to bring to bear what I have in a way that might be relevant rather than just...
It's interesting that the psychotherapist is being questioned and actually needs help in order to answer the questions.
Exactly.
That's always good.
Let me add that I am a registered psychologist as well, which means that I am Medicare listed, and that is an important thing in terms of what it costs for folks to get therapy.
We'll get back to that cost a bit later on.
Yep.
But what did you want to know, Russ?
I want to know what a psychotherapist is.
They're psychologists, psychiatrists,
psychotherapists.
So, Tori, what is the difference between, let's say, a psychotherapist, psychologist, and psychiatrist?
The probably most, in some respects, important difference is that psychotherapist is not a classified name, whereas a psychiatrist and psychologist both are. They are. You have to be a registered practitioner in order to use those words as descriptors for yourself, whereas a psychotherapist does things that both of those sorts of folks might be doing, but doesn't necessarily have to be a registered psychologist or a psychiatrist.
But you are.
Yes.
So it'd be good to find a psychotherapist that is certainly a registered psychologist.
And that's obvious. Most of them will say that they're psychologists at least, or a clinical psychologist and so on. These are all registered names. You cannot use the name unless you are have the registration.
Because you've got a shingle outside your practice that says...
It says psychotherapist.
Psychotherapist.
And that's because I choose a generic description for the talking therapies, which psychotherapist is. And recently I found a long article by somebody who was busily trying to talk about generic features of therapy. And he decided that the simple word to use across all of these distinctions is psychotherapist.
Okay.
So it's just a way of labeling. I can't give you a good example in somebody else's game, but yeah.
Why would people be afraid of coming to see a psychotherapist? I was wondering, it's interesting. I mean, many moons ago and for many moons, I went and saw a psychiatrist for 20 odd years to deal with my demons.
Mm-hmm.
And initially I was amazed that I seemed to do a lot of talking, and we didn't seem to be going very far, but, you know, what would someone, for example, come and see you for, Tori, to do with addiction and the GLBTI community? Have you got any examples that you could use?
The bulk of my practice is in the family and institutional violence area.
Ah, right.
And that immediately gives you a number, 1 in 5 in the population, roughly.
Right.
Right. That's a lot of people.
Yeah.
With a significantly abused background.
Mm.
Do they all show up? No, lots of people don't. That's your question. Why are people afraid? We can get there in a sec.
Yeah.
But the streets are filled with abused people.
Yeah.
And we know that now. I mean, I'm not making those numbers up. Mm. They were created in a couple of major investigations over the last 5 years. And then there are other groups that we were talking about earlier, like the first responders, militaries, ambos, people like that, who are getting repeatedly abused, so to speak, by the live experiences that they're having. Another bunch as we're being created now, with the fact that there's relatively massive increase in suicide in the military as a result of the exposure roughly in Afghanistan,
right.
Mm-hmm. To this kind of stuff as well.
And also first responders like firefighters.
Yep.
You know, there's going to be problems due to the trauma caused by those things.
Exactly. Fireys, ambos, police, militaries, and I never can remember the fifth one.
Yeah. And then from there we're
talking. Stay with the question about why are people afraid often. I was going to ask you, you might be able to help us, but the generic is that one of the things that people who have been abused share is shame. Robustly reported all the time. Shame is a thing which teaches people to keep their mouth shut.
Yep.
Which takes us into the whole realm of secrets.
And secrets, and then keeping secrets from from yourself and to yourself. Hello, addictive behaviors, addictive substances, and perhaps also things like over or under eating, self-imposed.
Let's explore that a little bit further. Yeah. But what we might do is just how many years have you been practicing?
27 or so.
27 or so years, and your patients are from Melbourne?
Most are, but then they spread out. So I do stuff by Skype in particular, and sometimes a couple of other programs. And I have regular people, one in Shanghai, guy in Hamburg, woman in San Francisco, young guy in Bali who I've never, a number of people like that, a woman who I've only once or twice seen. So I've done all of the work on Skype.
Wow.
With some of those people, and it works perfectly.
Yeah.
It's
the same as a one-on-one in a...
Yeah.
In a consulting room.
A color picture is as good as the colored face.
Sure. So you have clients all around the world. Now, you mentioned to me something when we met about a week or so ago. I was talking about your blog spot, Diary of a Madman, and I thought maybe having read some of the posts from that you might be a theorist in psychology or in psychotherapy. But you talked about a general intellectual background.
My principal intellectual background is philosophy.
Okay.
Yeah, that, That was a long time ago, but it was all but dissertation. So four years undergraduate and 2 years of graduate school. I also have a teacher's qualification and organizational dynamics qualification. And I did a second degree. So I did psychology, not as an undergraduate, but rather at the age of, I started at the age of 45. For those of you out there who are looking for a career, it's never too late to start. And just so you can get the boundary around that one, I'm 77. All right. So that's the 27 years of of practice. And I'm still here kicking.
Yeah.
Right. And we know.
So and just, working. Just,
yeah. You know, that's what I meant. and we do know that one of the things that contributes to long life that's not genetics is having a life you want to lead.
Yeah.
And, usually,
and you want to lead this particular life. Otherwise, no question. You wouldn't be still doing it.
Exactly.
So you've got a wealth of experience through different types of patients. And so if I was psychotherapy shopping, I'd be looking for somebody that has a broader wealth of knowledge rather than maybe a new grad or something like that.
People shop for things they know about.
Yeah.
And one of the things that people know about is, oh, there are certain kinds of therapies which get lots of airtime. CBT is one of those, well recognized, and so on. So they go and shop for somebody who lists their therapeutic technique. Mm-hmm. I don't do that on the whole, but there's a market for that.
Right? Yeah,
and so that it's my market is people look at me and they say, right, this guy's been around a while, and I cite four or five aspects of my experience that you cannot get in a classroom.
Yeah.
Right? And that people are, oh, yeah, okay.
One of those is also being male, because I was surprised to find out that most psychotherapists and psychologists are female.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a question.
And teaching is the same gig in teaching.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I've got a question. So, shopping around for a psychotherapist.
Mm-hmm.
I've got an alcohol problem, or I did have an alcohol problem. I've been in recovery for a number of years now.
Mm-hmm.
Do I go and look for a psychotherapist that specializes in alcohol addiction, or can I just go and find anyone in the industry and just say, look, this is my thing. This is what I'd like to work on.
This is a classic of you shop for what you know.
Yeah.
Right? People who specialize in addictive drugs of various kinds do that. There are institutes that specialize in that, the recovery shops that specialize in that. My understanding of the reason that one gets addicted to something is because the shape of one's life is seriously injured.
Yep.
And that the symptom of that is the addictive activities, the addictive substances, but they are not the source.
You've got a particular way of approaching addiction. What are the roots of addiction?
Well, if we know, I go back to that number, I use 1 in 5 people in the Australian population have carrying significant backgrounds of sexual and other kinds of physical and non-physical abuse, right? Big numbers. They're out there.
20%.
Yep. And so we also know that that much of the experience they have is held in secret because people don't want to hear it. And they know, the people who've been abused know that other people don't want to hear it, because all they have to do is watch what happens if somebody pops up and says, I accuse, is they get berated.
Mm-hmm.
This is a very common thing, and in fact, it is almost an industry of berating so-called victims, and on it goes.
In any community, whether it be the LGBTI community.
My assumption, when somebody shows up with addictive, either a physical addiction to alcohol, whatever it might happen to be, or a psychological addiction in repetitive processes like OCD,
OCD
and things
yeah.
like that, various kinds of anxieties, is that they acquired those in abuse.
So it's a response to trauma.
It's a defense. That's right.
So
that's my expectation, and it says be ready for that to be there.
So in our LGBTI community, what sort of form would those traumas be?
Same as everybody.
What? Being discriminated, or?
Physical abuse,
yeah.
Various kinds, psychological abuse. Range from being bullied in public and other schools,
yeah.
and so on. I mean, there's the same gig. Mm. Anybody that a culture can find to pick on safely, they'll do it. Mm.
So that's possibly why we have higher rates in our community, because of the discrimination, being bullied, coming out experiences, bad coming out experiences, and not coming out experiences.
And the one I want to point out particularly is the word you used earlier, which was secrets.
Yeah.
It takes a huge amount of energy to keep secrets. Mm.
So if you're keeping your sexuality as a secret to yourself or to other people, it's going to boost those numbers. So that would be considered a trauma then in that case.
I would have thought it would have been considered their form of normal, isn't it?
What normalizing do you think, Russ?
Well, no.
Who are we talking about?
Yeah. No. Who's anyone, say anyone who's been abused, and they use whatever XYZ addiction to cover that up. Mm. I mean, they've got their form of normal is buried quite deep, and how they've got through life is by creating whatever they've had to create to get through life. So.
And so in that sense, the addictive responses to abuse are normal.
Yeah.
And hence, that's why I call them defenses. If you're undefended, you're dead.
Yeah,
true.
The defense stuff for many people starts in the womb almost, right? Finding ways to disappear while being present. And as I'm saying that, you may notice some people who really, it's hard to hear them. The voice isn't really quite there. And they may move in a way which is almost as if they're hiding or shrinking. And when I look at people, watch people walk. You can start doing this. Watch people walk and you see a walk which is restricted is an indication of the person being making themselves small.
Because they're carrying a secret, and it's something to do with the trauma they've had, and therefore they're acting that out in a physical way, quite obvious.
Course.
So if I arrive at your practice or any psychologist or psychotherapist practice, hopefully they're looking out for those key indicators, those sorts of things.
There's a I'd hope that's true too, but
it's not always going to happen.
No, the facts are reasonably clear that there are folks who mostly look at the apparent symptom as in fact the injury, and so they set about fixing the symptom.
Because I was about to actually disagree with myself, because somebody who's heavily into addiction is going to arrive at your practice with a huge ego. Very low self-esteem, but a huge ego in the first place. So they're not going to be possibly, well, it depends whether they're affected by whatever substance they're into.
You've got to admit that you've got an addiction.
Yeah, true.
As well.
Yeah, you've got to admit you've got an addiction. I know for me with the alcohol, I spent years going to see this particular psychiatrist, and every week this gentleman would say to me, have you had a drink this week? And I only had a drink 12 hours earlier. But my reply was always, no, I haven't. Or, how many AA meetings have you been to this week? And I would say, oh, six, and I hadn't been to one. And so, it's very hard. I would imagine it would be very hard to treat somebody like that who's...
Well, there are ways of but as I'm looking at you, I can be watching you lie, and I can see that physically in various ways, particularly as we noticed earlier that sometimes when people are lying, they flush.
Right.
Or something of that sort across the table we're pointing as and watch. See?
I've got my eyebrows always go up when I lie. That's my thing.
Your
it's
eyebrows,
true.
Are, your
it's
eyebrows
true.
Are up most of the time. But these are all normal signaling.
Yeah.
That's the point. It's why they're visible and why they can be engaged. Yeah. And I work the body in that way.
Yeah.
As we're talking, somebody's talking, and when they get close to serious material, their breathing changes, their skin pallor changes, all sort of stuff like that. That can be worked and become part of the treatment.
Yes.
As awareness increases,
I was a bit scared about coming to your rooms ever again, but like,
it's too late.
If I arrived, I know it is. If I arrived at your practice, are you going to say to me, well, you know, clearly you've got a big addiction problem. What are you going to say when I arrive?
Oh, it's very simple.
What's that?
What can I do for you?
Okay.
That's it.
That's it.
And the first problem that people have is speaking about their secret, whatever they consider them to be.
And it's, yeah, I mean, unbeknownst to me, unless you talk, you can't resolve anything.
Yeah, especially if you're using talk to try and hide it.
Yeah, and you can't ask for help. So you've got to start talking, don't you?
So that technique actually pushes it back onto the person that I'm here to listen to you, but that means you've got to speak.
Yeah, of course. But, somebody to get to that point, I suppose they are subconsciously looking for help.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Not even subconsciously.
Although in your case, Russ, you weren't looking for help, even though you were continuing to go along. Were you pleasing somebody else, perhaps?
Well, I was sent there by my GP for depression and, from there, we moved on to the trauma of being bullied at high school. And from there, we went on to my addiction to alcohol. I mean, I can understand the whole process now, and I think it was very, very helpful to me at the time. But it took me there's no quick fix as far as I'm concerned. This is just for me personally. I feel great today, but it's been 20 or 30 years of work with psychologists, psychiatrists, other human beings just to talk through things.
So. 20 is not an unusual number for people carrying a significant trauma burden because the trauma reiterates in relationships throughout the lifespan.
So it gets acted out.
Yeah. It's present. Right? And it can be guessed at as likely to occur, but at each lifespan move, so moving from age 22, which is young adult, to early 30s, which is maybe almost an adult, right? Yeah. To the late 40s, when you're on the edge of being able to answer the following question, what are you going to do when you grow up?
Yeah.
You guys are, I'm sorry, these guys are
We've
both
grown
old.
Up.
They've grown up.
Okay. Put it bluntly.
And then some.
I was going to ask, are there certain people that are more likely to be prone to addiction? You know, it's that nature-nurture type of thing. We're sort of answering it in a way of trauma, which would be more to do with nurture, I suppose. But is there a tipping point where trauma becomes just too much? You know, I'm just.
Let's put it this way. Almost everything is multiply determined.
Which means
that there are a variety of factors contributing to the person's state, not just one. So it's not just personality, and it's not just family of origin, and it's not just school and so on. Mm-hmm. It's the mix of things in various configurations, which for each person are roughly guessable. So I can almost always guess roughly what the configuration is, but everyone is different.
Yeah.
And the difference part is the human uniqueness bit. The guessable part is human structures and systems and so on. But somebody's particular experience of whatever it is that their life has been, for them, is special. I'm smiling while I'm saying this. and they're looking at me like, oh my God, what is he saying?
Right. Well, no, that brings me to humor. Because I've spent my life hiding behind humor to keep my secret. Well,
you're almost ready to be a therapist.
I am. I'd love to be. To keep my secret safe because I know I'm safe. Being the class clown, being funny, always seeing the funny side to things, all of that sort of stuff. It's just a safe place to be. And if you've got trauma and you don't want other people to know about it, I mean, who's going to guess that someone's, you know, depressed or an addict or something when they're laughing all the time? I'm curious. Yeah.
Well, obviously, your therapist has certainly been, would have been able to tell exactly what was going on because he was asking you those leading questions, which you were denying all the way through.
And but even through the therapy, though, if we weren't able to laugh, it wouldn't. Well, I feel as though it wouldn't work. Wouldn't have worked for me because. I felt as though that I needed to laugh about the things that I'd created such a huge drama around.
Yeah.
That it was a relief to tell another human being, but then to see the lighter side of it. Yeah.
It sort of seems a little bit theoretical, some of the discussions that we're having tonight. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, because we've talked about addiction in our LGBTI community, as well as one in five Australians walking down the street. So 20% of the population is wandering the streets with
abuse backgrounds
and problems from trauma somewhere in their lifetime. Because I was thinking before we even started tonight, I was thinking, God, if you're one of the four in five, you've really been quite lucky, actually, to get through life this far. And, you know, it sort of indicates that our community, of course, suffers greater trauma in secrets and also other events such as discrimination and, you know, problems in our sexuality and our coming out and not coming out and all that sort of stuff. Do you have a... I don't know, maybe a case study that you want to share with us?
One of the well-known things about trauma is that it tends to be familial and multi-generational, so that when I'm working with somebody, I'll give a case. This one, the patient has said, you can talk about this. I'm not going to talk about exactly it, but close enough. It is real. When somebody shows up and they've got an alcohol issue, let's say, you can bet that there's an alcohol issue back a generation and or two.
Why is that?
Because human inhumanity to humanity is generic or it's just repetitive. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at my favorite place is partly China, lived there extensively and so on, but you could have the same story in the Balkans, let's say. I was talking about that. The story is folks who grew up in those places, whether they know it or not, grew up in massively socially traumatized times. Mm. Right? So this was where the trauma was all around people. And that if you survived, you were lucky. This is a level of trauma that is systemic. And is totally indifferent to families or anything else like that. Everybody is in trouble. Australia, for the most part, except in special communities, LGBTI, Aboriginal and so on, where repeated assault of various kinds can be expected every day. The rest of the stuff is familial, but usually a couple of generations. So that if a family's got difficulties, question I'd ask is what was happening two generations ago, which, in case you don't know where that is, that's Second World War.
Yeah.
Right? And what happened? Well, people came back from the war, if they survived, and they couldn't talk about it because nobody wanted to hear the story. I mean, this is robust truth for the most part about these kinds of things. Oh, what about in your family, great grandparents? When's that? Oh, that's just between the end of the First World War and the Depression. Mm-hmm. And so again, massive social dislocations and so on and so forth, which everybody was putting up with, and the use of alcohol and other treatment, so to speak, has been very common in our kinds of cultures. So we do it, but it's around in all kinds of levels. And so the guy I'm going to talk about then is he learned not to breathe when he arrived for a session. He had trouble starting because he was holding his breath, and he had learned to hold his breath as a kid for all of his, until he moved out of the house, so till he was 20 or something like that, waiting for dad to come home from the pub, drunk, which he always did. And the first thing he did was walk into son's room to see if he was awake. And if he could be detected as awake, then he became prey. And so the guy learned not to breathe. And being good at not breathing kept him slightly safe. You're getting the point here.
It's
a good defense, except that the trouble is it's a bit incapacitating.
Absolutely.
He was lifted quite a bit by the fact that he's actually an artist. Somebody, teacher, discovered that when he was in primary school, when he got there, noticed him drawing, which people who have natural talents and things just do them. Right? And one of the great things teachers do is be able to see that sort of stuff and say, oh, that was a nice line you made. Yeah. Do you do that? Oh, yeah, regularly. Can I see them more? Yes. And that is a self-rewarding experience if you happen to have that kind of inner drive. Mm-hmm. And it's known to be a thing which helps pull people out of this sort of stuff because it is self-executable, right? Doesn't need much of anybody else to do it, and then can be converted into useful things. Like he could actually do design and graphic design and all kinds of stuff like that, which was marketable. But he was still alcoholic.
And that came even though his father was, because it was the repetition of a previous.
Yeah, and he couldn't talk about this stuff. He couldn't even talk about the stuff to his siblings because they all had different experiences of dad.
And different ways of dealing with that trauma.
Yeah. Which made the natural community for his trauma couldn't be it, namely his family, the siblings.
We were going to talk about vocation as well. Is that the manifestation of his vocation, the drawing and then...
That's what that is, yeah. That's, I'm using that word, vocation, a naturally occurring talent, if you want. Mm-hmm. You were talking about a naturally occurring talent for reading.
Mm.
Yep, same. I mean, people noticeably differ about that kind of stuff. I'm one of you.
Yeah.
And we can share who had the most interesting and weird readings at the age of seven or eight.
Good. Good old Enid Blyton.
Yeah, could be.
And
lead us on.
Yeah, well, that leads us to a family violence history. Let's talk about families. What do you want to tell us about families? It's a big question, isn't it?
I'll say the same thing about families that I would say about you. All the same and all different.
Yeah.
The thing that's shared about a person is that they usually have a number of human characteristics that are relatively reliable, and families have some characteristics too. Like in general, they tend to be composed of a dyad and spin-offs. The dyad is the pair creating children in the first instance. However, that's done, right? That's why I use the word dyad. Because that's the level of relationship. And then a dyad spins off a bunch of other dyads, which is all of the individual relationships between people. Anyway, that's the stuff that the way that I partly think about this sort of stuff is that they're a suite of social systems glommed together. An interesting way of looking at this is if you think about being a child, only child of a family, no siblings,
mm-hmm.
then the only child gets to own the responsibility in their mind for keeping the whole family together.
Wow.
Yeah.
Some people end up with an extraordinarily good family that does everything well and really one of those idyllic childhoods.
It's a fantasy, I think, is the word you're looking for.
It's a fantasy. but how do those people that, I'm not saying on the surface, but who have great experience, how can they still end up in that tipping area into addiction as well?
Are there people who are having a great experience who are also alcoholic? I would guess that they are hiding
secrets.
Why would you destroy most of your, I mean, you know about this. Why would you destroy most of your daytime by being sozzled?
Mm. Yeah.
Right? Well, you do that because it's better than whatever else is going on.
Maybe perfection was too good. Well, not enough. I'm just going to throw a little case in here. I'm gay, possible trauma in the past. yet I feel the need to suck as much tequila out of a bottle as I can. I'm doing it on a monthly, weekly, daily basis. What on earth am I doing and how can you help me?
Yeah, good. Okay, there's a technique for this. as you're telling the story, I remember the techniques.
Yeah.
One of the key things for someone who's a serious drunk is finding a way to not have the next drink.
Mm-hmm.
To do that requires a simple but difficult thing, namely understanding the trigger that makes you take the next drink.
Right.
And there is a technique, there's probably dozens, but one that I give people to play with, which is over the intervening week between this session and this event and the next one, you're going to drink. We're not trying to stop drinking now. All we're trying to do is find out what's triggering it. How many drinks can you get away with before you can't stop?
Mm-hmm.
Most drinkers know that. Mm-hmm. They know the number. Right, 3, 4, something in that kind of place is where it is. And anything beyond that, they're cooked. So at the point where you're about to go over the top, stop. You're not trying to stop. You're just interrupting it for a moment. Stop and notice what you think or feel.
Mm.
And it will be the thing at that moment which is driving the drink.
Right.
Because the drink is trying to cover up that thing.
Would that be the same for something like crystal meth or for?
I don't know. I've never worked with anybody.
For eating or overeating?
With the eating stuff, yes.
Lots of other addictions,
yes.
Or for OCD problems.
Yeah, yep. The triggers, it's called mood tracking. There's a couple of techniques for doing it, but they're basically getting yourself in a place where you can actually stop so you can notice what you're feeling.
What if I'm just sort of doing this only once a month?
Then you haven't got a problem.
I haven't got a problem.
Unless you're almost killing yourself once a month, drinking the bottle of tequila. I heard that one.
Or almost killing myself waiting for that opportunity once a month in order to do it.
Well, then you got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's called self-restraint.
I can remember losing my mobile phone once and instead of doing the logical thing, which was, you know, you go to Telstra and you ring them and tell them to cancel your phone and replace it and everything, the very first thing I did was rush home and eat an entire packet of Tim Tams.
Perfect. Got a problem with Tim Tams?
No, not anymore. I don't.
No.
I'm thinking, you know, I just can't deal with this. I've got to eat all of these Tim Tams and then I'll feel better.
Did you?
No.
Oh, that's terrible.
Well, what do you say about that, Tori?
I think I'd want longer before I said anything about it.
Okay.
Yes.
We also talked tonight about previous trauma, such as things happening to us as we're growing up or, you know, certainly in formative years of teenage and whatever. What about trauma later in life? Can that trigger an addictive response or addictive behavior as well?
I don't know the research on that particular thing. Trauma later in life can be seriously traumatizing, that's for sure.
Such as people that are in frontline areas, whether it be soldiers
the first
and
responders of various kinds, all of those things are clearly traumatizing because those folks keep showing up. And
How about tips for healthy mental health?
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. You talked to me the other day about the Big Five.
Did I?
Yes, Big Five.
Oh, good. Okay, yeah.
Can you remember the Big Five? Let us in on the secret.
And if you can't, then I know that you weren't listening.
That's
the Big Five, exercise.
Exercise.
Yep.
Sleep.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Eating right.
Yep.
Work right.
Yes.
Love right. Fucking brilliant.
That's
like
five.
That's five. That's
yeah,
it.
Yeah, that is.
Big Five.
So that's all we have to do
and
for great mental health.
What's love right?
You get straight to it, don't you?
I do, yeah. I mean, I get the others.
What do you mean it's taking them an hour?
I know, but like, what's love right? Yeah.
Reliable, enjoyable, good fit relationship.
Yeah.
So that could be friends, it could be family, it could be all sorts of things.
It's, not just passing by friends or something like that. It's reliable. So that would be, that friend stuff would be a component of that. Usually one thinks in adult life it's a good idea to have a pair up in some way. Mm. There is people who think you can pair up in all kinds of ways. I think that's an interesting proposition. Polyamorous munch and so on. I've worked for a number of folks in that area. Seems confusing, but then that probably means I'm simple-minded.
But it's finding the fit that's right.
That's right.
For you.
Right. And yeah. In that sense, if the fit is whatever you think is what you want that fit, and you can find other people to play that with you, that'll do.
Yeah.
Right. You may get berated in the street or something like that, and so that's maybe another matter. But
yeah. What about the work right part, the vocation or the thing that you do for security?
Probably the most notable thing about that is that it's not possible to be a great author, writer, musician, et cetera, and make a living.
Mm-hmm.
There are more people who are interested in doing those kinds of things than there are livings to be made doing right. them. That's clear. And so one thing that some folks do, I saw one of these folks this morning, is they nurture as much as they can their vocational music sort of thing. You find folks in little bands that run, and they go on for quite some while, and they do not bad job. They'll never make, you know, a whiz-bang living at it, but they enjoy doing it. There's art shows and all sorts of things like that. Amateurs and people are doing their stuff seriously, and you know, some of it looks good. But some of the bands, you'd rather leave them somewhere down in the bushes someplace. But
you could
radio host.
Yeah, look.
But the point
yeah,
is, you could be doing the same job over and over again. You know, you may not get great fulfillment out of it, but at the same time, then you know, you go off and practice with a band every week, and that's part of your work as well. So
that's right.
Just as
you say, it's not work; it's part of your vocation, so to speak.
As you say, Russ, we do radio together, and we really enjoy that, as well as what we do in our particular job. So it's a much broader thing than just I go to work every day and I work in a warehouse and I don't really enjoy it.
And that's sort of stuff. That's probably work that's not very good.
Yeah.
There's probably a lot of that around.
But, you know, some people have to do that to survive.
Well, and and then some people don't, even if they have to do it, they don't get to do it because they're in contract labor jobs, which disappear from day to day, all kinds. There's a bunch of social structural things that are not helpful, I think.
But, so I can't imagine that people don't come to you with expectations. Expectations on how you're going to make them better, or they've seen a movie, so you know you're going to hypnotize me tonight, and tomorrow I'm going to be well.
Good. I have a simple mantra for this, which fits the abuses and trauma area, which is. And I say exactly what I'm about to say, which is, I will help you get your power back. Mm. That resonates with most people.
Mm-hmm.
It's got very particular application in their lives, where they feel not powerful, and as a result feel deranged, distraught, you know, whatever it might
helpless.
Be. Helpless. Yeah, all kinds of things that. That's right. And that can lead then, for me, I often work with people on shifting relationships that they are in, family, work, various places like that, where let's say there are obnoxious characteristics that would be good if they could be pushed aside, step through, disregarded, and so on, all require taking action. And folks who are traumatized often don't feel too powerful.
Right.
And as well, they may have underdeveloped skills in confronting and so on and so forth. So
part of your job is giving that power back.
Yep.
Now, we talked about love right and work right. Eat and sleep, how important could they be? Do you find, people don't eat or sleep properly?
Well, the sleep is the one that they're both problematic, I guess. Yeah. I mean, the obesity matter has gone through the roof, apparently, in the last 20 years or thereabouts, particularly in folks generation younger than everybody in the room here, that 30-40%, something like that, is a number that I saw, which means there's some really whack job thing going on out there in the culture on the food consumption side.
Sleep is
one thing I benefited from in my life was a capacity to fall asleep almost anywhere, anytime. This is a great capacity, not enjoyed by much of humanity, as far as I can tell. But it means that it was always possible for me, and I still do it now. I sit in a chair and have a nap. You know, if you can do that, you can wire together a whole bunch of junk that might be quite messy otherwise.
It's pretty important, though.
Getting on a bus or a train.
And the last thing there was on the list, which I believe is your first one, is exercise.
Yes.
And you put it quite interestingly when we met up a week ago. It was as little as, you know, because you may not feel very powerful at all. You might feel very tiny and very unable to do anything, but you put it down as just even walking down the street and back.
Oh, yeah, that's well known as a thing. I recommend, however, that people, if they're going to be serious, take a martial art because that, A, gives people the experience of potentially being able to be powerful, and the exercise is great. But walking around, an hour a day is...
You said you could walk down to the end of your street and back, and not be noticed or not notice anything, and then maybe the next time you just see somebody, and maybe the third or fourth time you just actually do a simple nod, and it's suddenly giving a connection
That's social, social.
And it's starting to get a social thing happening.
Yep.
Doesn't it feel that it's only been the past 10, maybe 20 years where, you know, we've all started talking about mental health and it's now okay to, you know, go and see a psychologist or a psychotherapist and it's not a big deal anymore. You know what I mean?
So what's your point?
It's a badge of honor?
Well, I don't know. I just don't.
My psychotherapist is telling me this, I just feel as though I
don't know whether you get to an age, you know, that where it's a bit like you were saying that, you know, it's not till you get to your 40s that you think, oh, what am I going to do when I grow up? But, you know, there is certainly talk amongst lots of people these days, oh, well, you know, I'm not feeling too good at the moment. I'm going to see a psychologist to work through blah, 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 blah. I mean, it's... the point I'm trying to get across is it's just more accepted in society today that that's the word I'm looking for, less shameful to admit I've got a problem at the moment, I need some help.
That seems to be the case.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We hope that you've enjoyed tonight's show and remind you that if you're experiencing immediate problems or if content of this program raises issues that cause distress, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or Beyond Blue on 1300 22 46 36.
I'd like to thank Tori for coming on the show tonight. It's been an excellent evening and I've learned a little bit more about psychotherapy that I didn't know. But always remember, it is important to move away from self-destructive reasoning. Recovery involves breaking the cycle of addiction, removing the trigger of negative thinking and restoring us to emotional sobriety. One of the greatest highs in life is feeling good about ourselves. Always remember that none of us are alone in this world, and the first step in recovery is always to ask for help.
Ah, yes, we want our community to be one of hope and look forward to your company next week as we continue to explore addiction on Hooked. Meanwhile, it's goodbye from Russ.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me, David. Goodbye.
Joy 94.9 is a GLBTIQ community radio station in Melbourne, Australia. Support Joy 94.9 by becoming a member at joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.